kind of a variable capacitor, because you can change the amount of penetration of one rod into the other. And then the attachment point is another one of the variables. So you slide the block of metal that attaches the gamma rod to the driven element, you slide that rod, that block of metal in and out toward the center or out toward the tip, and you change the length of the rod that is telescoping inside of the series gamma rod, which is the series capacitor. That's the way many people build a gamma match. There are other ways. N2NNU, K2RIW. Go ahead, Alex.
I let it drop for a second. Yeah, you putting words in my mouth. I didn't mention anything about transformers here. I described the ready match that I was playing around for the last week, and this is meant, it is built by Kushner. It is a rod, isolated rod sliding in and out of a tube that then is connected to the driven element by that clamp that you mentioned. Well, there are two components to that, electrical components to that little contraption. One, it is the capacitor that you are looking at, and that is within the internals of the tube itself, between the internal wall and the rod. But then you have an inductor also that is an external wall of the rod going along from its end to the clamp and then through the clamp to the boom. And those things, this capacitor and the inductor are series connected. So when you adjust one of them, you adjust both of them. This is the interdependence of that that stuff. It's very hard to deal with it. Anyhow, having said that, a correctly built gamma match will do wonderful stuff. Only if the isolator inside is not changing with time. I called up Kushcraft today and told him, listen, I had some problems with that. He said, well, you know, now and then, about 2 or 3 years along the line, you have to change that gamma match because the insulator is changing its dielectric capacitor specification. So, all in all, it is a capacitor and an inductor in series, interdependent. We'll change one, you change one, you change the other one too. Back to Dick.
Oh, I agree with that. The length of it is a kind of a series inductor. The telescoping tubing is a kind of a series capacitor. You've got to worry about does the plastic inside, if it was, for instance, Delrin, if it was Rexolite. At one time, people thought that was a superior magnetic, a superior microwave material, and Rexolite outdoors eventually depolymerizes and changes its dielectric constant as it dries out. So you got to keep the weather out of the capacitor of the gamma rod. You got to worry about it changing in time. Gamma-fed antennas are not my favorite type. I'm much more in favor of a T-match after a half-wave coax balance, but that's me. It's a much more symmetric, a much more long-lived feeding arrangement, in my opinion. But there's a zillion ways of feeding that driven element. Delta, gamma, direct gap feeding, folded dipole, and so on. And you could build a gamma rod to the right and to the left as a kind of a T-match if you wanted to. There's lots and lots of variations. But as long as that driven element acts like a dipole in the way it radiates and gives you a good impedance match, and it's got low insertion loss of its components, and as long as it's protected from the weather, then it's doing the job as far as making the rest of the Aggie perform. I think Glenn had one more comment. I'm going to go over to him, and then we got to go to Len and Les pretty soon, because we're keeping these four guys waiting. KC2QIQ, go ahead, Glenn. K2LIW in the TechNet. Okay, maybe Glenn got called away. Hey, Len, sorry to keep you waiting this long. WB2QEQ. K2RIW. You got it, Len. Okay, maybe Len got called away. Let's see if Les is still with us. K2GGW. Les, I hope you're there. K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2QIQ.
Didn't run away, Dick, at all. My simple question. I had stacked 2 meter halos once upon a time. One got affected by the weather. and I took it down, rebuilt it, and now I want to restack them. I just don't remember the distance to keep them apart, the stacking distance. I thought it was one wavelength. Something I saw on the internet said 40 inches. I don't know how to get back to the correct distance to stack them.
Yeah, the way you choose the stacking distance of any antenna that you're stacking horizontally or vertically is to know what is the effective area of the antenna. That effective area, in the general case, is an elliptical-shaped area. In the case of a long Yagi, it starts approaching a perfect circle. But if you know the true gain of the antenna, then you know the real area it has to have in order to produce that gain. There's a direct relationship between effective area and gain. And you choose the stacking distance as a compromise. As you stack closer, you get a cleaner looking pattern. But those little areas are starting to overlap now. Those areas are starting to overlap, and you lose a little bit of gain. As you stack them further, you're no longer overlapping, you pick up a little more gain, but now the pattern becomes a little bit more ugly. Ugly meaning that the main lobe becomes a little more narrow, the side lobes get a little bit stronger, and there's a deep null between the main lobe and the first side lobes. When you're vertically stacking, and as long as you've done a good job and that main lobe is on the horizon, the exact number of beamwidths, degrees of vertical beamwidth of that main lobe doesn't matter very much. So the difference between one wavelength and 40 inches is very, very little, 42 inches. I think a wavelength on 2 meters is something like 38 inches. And so if you did a careful plot of gain and pattern versus stacking distance of your halos, you would find that the performance changes very slowly. In other words, you would not see any significant gain decrease if you started off with, let's say, a 40-inch stacking distance and you went down to a 30-inch stacking distance. You'd probably lose a couple of tenths of a dB of gain. And if you went from a 40-inch to a 50-inch, you'd probably pick up a tenth of a dB of gain. It's going to change very slowly, Les. There's no real magic number there that you have to hit right on the nose. As long as you've got a good power divider, and as long as between the power divider and your two halos, you've got the exact same length of cable to the nearest inch or so, and as long as each halo is tuned the same. Now, halos tend to be a very, let me drop. Halos tend to be a fairly narrow band antenna. As such, it is possible to have one of them peaked at 144 and the other one peaked at 147 megacycles, in which case you would have a phase shift of your two antennas, not because of the difference in phase length of the cables from the power divider to the antenna, but because of the tuning of the antenna itself. So if you're doing a real thorough job on that, you will feed a cable directly to each halo first and confirm that each one gives you a reasonable standing wave ratio. That would apply at your favorite frequency, and maybe it's 146.85. And so make sure that they both have very similar performance before you combine the two. But that exact stacking distance is not super critical. And as I said, if you know the true gain of the halo, and you work the formula for gain equals 4 pi a over lambda squared. The 4 pi in lambda squared is a constant. Gain is a constant times area. If you know the true gain of the antenna, you can calculate the area. Once you know the area, you know the size of its circle or ellipse, and you could, if you want to, do a real exact science experiment of plotting gain fall off versus stacking distance because of the areas overlapping. Don't worry about it. We're talking about tenths of a dB of difference here, less, and 40 inches is close enough. Allow that stacking distance to be more dictated by the mechanics of your particular boom that your particular mass that you're mounting it to, rather than thinking that there's some exact stacking distance that's going to make the antenna perform or crash. K2TGW, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Understand, Dick. No, they're both tuned to exactly 144.200. One that went out, when I guess it got wet, the insulation or the top part on top of it got wet, and it went awry, and the whole thing got ruined. I corrected that, and after the snowstorm, or a couple more degrees of warmth, I'll go back to stacking them, and I'll go back to the 40 inches. I could swear it was 40, but I think prior to that, it had 44 from the manufacturer. I don't remember, it's all far back. But thanks for your help, and thanks for the confidence. K2TGW, be clear.
Yeah, you put that together with reasonable mechanical integrity, Les. And if you did an experiment of 36, 40, and 44 inches, you would be very hard-pressed to measure any significant difference in performance. And that's the standing wave ratio, gain, vertical beam width, the works. It's going to change very slowly. It's not one of these exact sciences. The length of the directors of a Yagi on, say, 432, you better get those lengths to the nearest 16th of an inch of accuracy if you want to get the performance the guy told you about in the article you're duplicating. That's a delicate arrangement. But stacking distance, many inches of error would be required before you'd see any real difference in performance. Glenn, KC2QIQ, who's back? Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, thanks, Dick. Dick, sorry I had to slip out there for a second or so. But, yeah, my question tonight is about Doppler antennas. I had the pleasant experience of going on a transmitter hunt with Andy's WA2CDL, and we did a little bit of transmitting and hunting, and he had a Doppler in his car, which really makes what a fantastic difference in finding hidden transmitters. Unbelievable. So I guess my question tonight is, I was looking at some kits that they have from Ramsey that have the Doppler units, but that doesn't come with an antenna. And I was wondering if maybe there's some information that you might have about Doppler antennas, preferably the four element or four antenna type designs, and maybe there's some things I can look for or want to pay attention to when selecting an antenna for that.
There may have been a station in there after Glenn dropped, but it was so extremely noisy we couldn't hear anything. The next time you try, I'll listen on the input and see if you're there. We keep calling it a Doppler antenna. It's called a Doppel scan. The Doppel scan article appeared in QST, I guess back in the late 80s, early 90s. I'm not sure when. And it's an arrangement of four, five, six, or eight. Usual, the antennas, the four, five, or six antennas are in a circular pattern. Usually they're quarter-wave ground plane type antennas. And you've got individual cables going to the individual antennas. This is a circular layout of four vertical dipoles on a sheet of metal, four vertical monopoles, I should say, on a sheet of metal, usually sits on top of the car. And the four cables come to a switching arrangement. And the switching arrangement with diode switching switches between the antennas at a very rapid rate, microseconds-like rate. And as such, it's as if you were physically moving the antenna to each one of those positions in sequence, and therefore the receiver does see an increase and decrease in the apparent phase angle, which looks like a frequency shift, and it therefore looks like a Doppler shift. You're really changing the position at which you're doing the reception. The bottom line of all this is that when you've got a good one, you get this beautiful indicator in the cockpit of the car that tells you the direction of arrival of the signal, assuming you're in a clean environment and there's only one signal, one direction of arrival. You drive through the marble canyons of New York City where the signals are reflecting off all of those buildings, and now the display starts getting very complicated, and it takes quite a bit of Kentucky windage practice, so to speak, in order to be able to interpret the display to figure out what is the direction of arrival. When you're doing, let me drop.
Dick, WA2CDL.
Andy recognized. When you're doing bunny hunting with a Doppler scan, it is very nice to know the direction you have to go with your car, as opposed to studying your S-meter as you go hopefully closer and further away. And if the guy is changing his power at the same time, he can confuse the daylights out of you. So a Doppler scan makes bunny hunting a much more pleasant experience. That's what you're talking about. Now, the Ramsey kit, which does a Doppler scan, is controversial. That is to say, a number of people have simply built the Ramsey kit and had mediocre performance. The switching arrangement that's in there makes spikes that the ideal switching, diode switching, would create no additional spikes as you're switching from an antenna number 1, 2, 3, and 4. But those spikes throwing down the poor receiver will sometimes drive the receiver crazy, and the display becomes nowhere near as clean. And so there's all kinds of modifications required in the past for the Ramsey kit in order to make it perform well. Now, maybe Ramsey was smart enough to collect all that information from various amateurs who did manage to tune them up and make them work well, and hopefully Ramsey has incorporated all that in the currently available kit. And so maybe Andy's going to tell us about that. Andy, how many Doppler scans have you built? How difficult was it to make them work? What brand names did the raw Ramsey unit do what you wanted to do before you made improvements to it? The B2CDL, our technical name at K2RAW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, I heard my ears perk up, and that's why I chimed in. Say hello to Glenn. First of all, that article in QST I was searching for you, Glenn, to see if where it is, and I found it in the archives. So I will make a copy and give it to you, or tell you which QST to look in. On the Doppel scan. That's what it's called. So I can show you that one. And I built a few Ramsey kits. And by the way, that design came from, and I forget the guy's name, WA2EBY. He originally published an article in QST, and then they made it into a kit form, and Ramsey furnished the kit. That you can also look up. I have the QST article, but I have to find it. So I don't remember which year it's in. So, the Ramsey kit actually works quite well. It's got its quirks, as you mentioned. There are some modifications that came out over the years to improve the sensitivity. And what I mean by that is, you know, interference from other outside signals, as well as ignition noise from the car, which could be a factor also. They've improved the filtering on the DC supply. And then later on, they came out with a crystal-controlled version. Instead of using a 555 free-running oscillator, which the original Doppelscan uses, they went to a more precise crystal time base and locked everything to that to improve its accuracy. So that was one change. And there were a few other articles. This guy, Joel Mowell, he has a book that's published, which also gives different versions of direction finding, including a Doppler that you can build. If you want to call it a Doppler. Actually, Dick had another repeater. Time out.
Yeah, the last 15 seconds, I heard you on the input, Andy. And you was asking whether or not we have any further questions about the Doppel scan and how it works. So I'll pass it open to the group. Anyone's got any further questions for Andy, me, or anyone else on how Doppel scan works? Whatever. By the way, if you just take the word Doppel scan, I'm not quite sure how you spell it, but if you go to the QST archives, which right now QST has made all of their articles in QEX, QST, and I think even Ham Radio Magazine, all of the articles are now archived, available to members, free of charge for downloading. So if you go to their search engine while you're in the archive section of QS of ARRL and put in Doppel scan, and maybe if Andy told us correctly, Whiskey Alpha 2, Edward Delta Yankee, you'll rapidly find that article and you could read the original. Anybody got any further questions? Give us your call letters and name right now. K2RIW on the TechNet.
KC2QIQ.
Glenn recognized. Anyone else?
And that's you.
Yeah.
And I got a correction on the call you gave.
Okay. Go first with the correction, Andy. What is the correct call letters?
By the way, sorry for timing it out. I talked too long. WA2, Whiskey Alpha 2, Easy, Bravo, Yankee, EBY. You can look him up. He came up with that circuit that Ramsey uses, WA2EBY.
Very good. That'll make it. Once you've got those call letters, the easiest way I find to do a search in the archives of ARRL is to use call letters. Rarely does a guy write more than one, two, or three articles. There's a couple of exceptions, like Joe Wright at W1JR, W1JAA. He's got a whole bunch of different call letters. Yeah, he's got a zillion articles, but the rest of us mortals, we've only got a few articles. You search by call letters, and you'll find a list of them right away. Glenn, KC2QIQ, go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, I guess one of the biggest questions that I've had with these antennas are, what about cable links and words, do they all have to be equal length of cable with the same amount of phase shift? Other questions are, what's an ideal, like for 2 meters, what's the ideal resonant frequency of the antennas that should they be tuned for? Should they be tuned for a single frequency, slightly off a little bit? Are the antennas tuned for 50 ohms? Just general questions like that. And also the spacing between them. Are they set up just like a four square, or is the spacing more critical, or are there other things that have to be taken into consideration? I'm not sure who's going to answer all that first, but WA2CDL, K2RIW, KC2, QIQ.
Let's add another question for me. Yeah, we're going to get you in it right next to Alex. I'm going to ensure the machine has dropped. Joe, we're going to pick you up also. Turns out that you do have to have equal lengths of cable to each of the antennas because the phase shift that the receiver sees as you go from antenna 1 to 2 to 3 to 4 should follow a circular pattern. So yes, the length of the cable to each of the antennas should be the same. Hopefully the diode switching arrangement should have the same insertion loss and stray capacitance and whatever. Each of the four antennas, if you use the four antenna version, should be tuned to the same frequency. And if you're trying to do 2 meter Doppel scanning, you're going to get the greatest sensitivity when the antennas are tuned to 2 meters. There is no magic about tuning the antennas a little bit low or high or right in the center of the band. If you're doing Doppel scanning direction finding at 146.25 because you're listening to the guy's input frequency, then you're going to get the greatest sensitivity if the antennas are tuned there. Ordinary quarter wave ground plane type antennas are reasonably broadband, so that's not much of a problem. You tune them 146.25, and I don't think you'd have any real problem doing Doppel scanning from 144.0 to 148.0, 147.99. So that's not super critical. The method of operation is that at a sequential manner, somewhat similar to a synchronous detector, in a predictable manner, you're shifting the electronic phase center of the antenna that's doing the listening. It's obvious that if, for instance, the signal was coming from the north, when you switch to the most northern of your four antennas, you're going to get the most advanced phase shift of reception. And when you switch to the most southern antenna of your four antennas, you're going to get the greatest phase shift of the reception. The receiver is looking at those phase shifts. It interprets them by way of your discriminator as instantaneous frequency shifts, and therefore the post-detection processing looks at those phase shifts versus frequencies coming out of your discriminator, which are synchronized with the switching of the antennas, and it therefore figures out the direction of arrival by the logic involved and lights up the appropriate bulbs indicating the direction of arrival of that signal on your display device. Rather crafty technique. Okay, Alex wanted to add some extra words or questions into NNU, K2RIW. Go ahead, Alex. TVN, we'll get to you after Alex. Correction, we're going to go to TVN, then to Joe, RYY, and then Alex first, then Joe, and then TVN. Alex, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Dick. I have a question. What happens if the phase of the received wave is changing during the scan from one antenna to another? This seems to be a real flaw with this system. Back to you.
You would think it would be a flaw, Alex, and you've used good common sense. The rate at which you shift the antenna switching is extremely fast compared to the rate at which you are FM modulating with your voice on that signal. So now the rates are so different, and there's also a correlation phenomenon. In other words, even if you did have a fairly fast rate of frequency slash phase modulation of the original signal, only at a particular rate of phase shift, which is equivalent to the switching rate of your switching network to the antennas, that's the only one that's going to correlate into the synchronous demodulator. You could call it a four-port synchronous demodulator as part of the post-detection processing going on here. So unless you were modulating at a very fast rate and at a rate that is synchronous with the switching of the antennas, that alone would not confuse the Doppel scan. I think the typical switching rate is in microseconds, where your voice is modulating that signal, FM modulating that signal in milliseconds. You see where I'm going here, Alex? N2NNU, K2RYW.
Yeah, okay, my question was too broad. Let me rephrase that. What happens if the incident wave phase changes faster than the switching of the antenna? That's what I wanted to ask.
Okay. If you knew for a fact that somebody's using a doppelscan, and if you wanted to spoof it, if you wanted to use electronic countermeasures, and you therefore phase shift at a rate that is faster than the rate at which the antenna switching is taking place, because the antenna switching and the correlation that gives you the direction of arrival has a time constant of approximately 1 second, but you're doing switching in microseconds, you really are using an integration factor of close to 1,000,000 to 1, microsecond versus second. Therefore, a lot of data is being correlated when the post-detection logic comes up with the apparent direction of arrival. In order for you to spoof this system, you would have to be phase shifting at a very fast rate, at a very large magnitude, like quarter of a 90 degrees of phase shift in microseconds. You would be smearing your signal all over the planet in the process of doing that. And because of the integration factor and correlation characteristic, unless you did it at a harmonic rate, unless you did it at a rate that is closely harmonically related to the switching rate, I think you would not be successful in doing a countermeasures. Is that sort of what you're looking for, Alex? Go ahead.
No, I don't looking into that. The intuition tells me here that, without getting into great detail of mathematics for now, that if the phase of the incident wave changes from one point to another during the scan between two antennas, you will get a Reynolds data no matter what you're doing, no matter how long the integration will be done. Because you raised the spectre of it, yeah, you can actually phase shift much, much faster than the 500 kilohertz shifting rotational of the antenna, because I think it's much less, the integration is taking over a 360 degree circle. So to get from antenna 1 back to antenna 1 takes quite a long time. So if the phase shift is done during this time, the indication will not be correct.
Agreed. But at the reasonable rate at which you're shifting the phase, you're going to create a few degrees of error in the apparent direction of arrival. And the display in general is not that accurate. In order for this thing to really be accurate, you would like to use more than four antennas in a circular pattern. You'd like to be using, let's say, eight antennas. It would give you a more accurate answer. But it would be a hell of a lot more hardware, and the rate of improvement would be kind of slow. You'd be well into the law of diminishing returns. If the original modulation of the signal itself was biphase shift keying, or BPSK, at a high subcarrier rate, yes, I think that could create a moderate amount of confusion. But, to my knowledge, the system takes a number of cycles around the 360 degrees in azimuth and integrates them. I think the display integrates for approximately 1 second, which represents a large number of cycles of shifting of the antennas, all properly integrated in a correlated manner. It is a kind of a synchronous demodulator. You could call it a four-port synchronous demodulator. Okay, I think Joe wanted to say some words about this. W2RYY, I think I heard you in there a few times. K2RYW, go ahead, Joe.
I want to make a comment, but not about this. The comment that I want to make is I'm noticing something wrong with your transmitter out at Selden. The audio is a little distorted as far as the recovered audio that I'm hearing coming out of that transmitter. Maybe if you get a couple of minutes, you could take a listen to yourself, listen to somebody talking at 85 and go between east and west, and tell me if you notice the same thing.
Hey, okay, the way I've got these receivers set up right now, I can transmit through Selden by doing this. Hello, I think I'm now transmitting through Selden. And my voice is not quite as loud, a little bit more muffled, and I'd much rather go to the eastern, to the western transmission. And I think you're saying the rate at which the audios are set up, there's some distortion out there. Sorry to hear that. I know that Eric and Andy are working on that. Mr. TVN, I think it was Tango Victor November. Give me your full call letter, sir, and your name, and proceed with your question or comment. I'm KQRIW. My name is Dick. Go ahead, sir. Okay, I think I heard Tango Victor November Mobile. And let's see now. It's either Joe or Glenn has some further questions. Let's see, let me give one more try to Len. WB2QEQ, who signed in earlier and said he had a question. Are you there, Len? KQRIW. Yeah, it looks like we kept Len waiting a little bit too long, and he had to go somewhere else. Okay. Glenn, did you have some further questions or comments on all of the above? After that, I'm going to go over to Mel for his questions on his comments on all of this. KC2QIQ, who's getting excited about a doppelscan. KQRIW in the TechNet.
K2YL.
YL recognized. We'll pick you up in a minute. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, very good, Dick. I just want to finish this off by saying, you know, 2 weeks ago, Andy invited me out to do one of these transmitter hunts, and I just honestly have to say it was a very fun experience, and I have to tip my hat there again to Andy. And my first time actually doing one of these kinds of transmitter hunts with my HT and Andy's, Doppler scan, and it was absolutely amazing. It was a real fun time, just getting out there with the hams, searching around, hunting for this, and now I've kind of got the bug, and I'll tell you, I think when the weather gets warm, you're going to see more of these transmitter hunts, and anybody else out there with an earshot, boy, these things are a lot of fun. You got to try one of these. So back over to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, I sure do hope that Limark reestablishes the weekly, monthly, whatever, fox hunt, bunny hunt, because it is well known that the repeater group, as they get larger and larger, the repeater groups that have a good fox hunting crew are the ones that have essentially no jamming for a very obvious reason. No smart jammer is going to attack a repeater group that is known to have a real good fox hunting team, because they're going to zero in on the guy real fast. As I did some searching around the country by putting out a question to the listserv that I'm a member of, the Tom Williams WA1MBA listserv, I asked how many of you guys on your local VHF, UHF repeater have experienced jamming, and what have you done about it? Oh boy, did I get a whole bunch of answers. And the most significant answer, let me tell you, came from the Dallas-Fort Worth area. They had a couple of very vicious jammers there that went on for long periods of time. And they got a better and better fox hunting crew, and they eventually zeroed in on the guy. And this particular individual was a former member of their repeater group who became disgruntled with the current management or the politics, and he expressed himself in that manner. Eventually, they got the FCC to remove some of the equipment from his house. He went out and bought more equipment. Eventually, he was doing the jamming by doing it mobile from a car, and he thought he was real good at changing power and changing locations and whatever. They eventually cornered him on the street, and it got down to a fist fight in the street in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, from what if I heard correctly. In other words, there are people who just insist on jamming because they think it is their God-given right or what, I don't know. But the guys in Los Angeles and the guys in Dallas have had a fair amount of trouble. But with perseverance, you can settle the problem. And so it just takes a matter of technology and perseverance, as I see it. And I may be misquoting the story a little bit, but I think you got the general gist of it. Let's see. K2YO, I think that's Bernie. Go ahead with your question or comment, Bernie. K2RIW in the TechNet.
One more comment, Dick?
We'll put you on the list, Glenn. Go ahead, Bernie.
Good evening, Dick in the net. My comment was for Glenn. Glenn, the Ramsey unit does include antennas. In fact, you might want to go to Ramsey's website, dig down a little bit, and you can actually download the DFF manual for the product. And it'd be an interesting read. I know you're a pretty good engineer, so it'd be kind of fluff stuff for you, but it'll give you a real good feel of what's in the product and how to set it up, et cetera, et cetera.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, thanks a lot for the information, because like everything else, this is all new to me. So I'm actually learning this one from the ground up. completely new. First time I saw it with Andy, and wow, what a blast. And just to add one more comment with this one, between Andy and myself, we found it in the dark. It took us within a 3.5 mile radius. We found the hidden transmitter in 15 minutes in the dark, and eventually Andy had to get out his big flashlight, and I held my HT, and we walked right over to it, Vic. 15 minutes, get that one. A lot of fun. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Going through Sullivan, Vic. Okay, you want me to transmit from Sullivan? Is that what you said, Eric? No, please. Okay. It's going to be a little bit difficult because of the delay, but here we go.
I have no problems hearing Yonkers.
Okay, this is KQLIW. Just coming in from Sullivan. And there's some other difficulty. He keeps talking when I hear him. Ooh! Boy, did that audio go up there. It's rather difficult to keep talking when I hear my own voice being fed back to me a couple of seconds later. I keep hearing this beautiful voice, and I want to stop and listen to it. And as soon as I stop and listen to it, it stops talking to me. Very similar to the problem you have when you start doing satellite work, and you got, in a case of most of the satellites, you've got like a third of a second delay. And if you're doing moon bounce with audio, you got 2.5 seconds delay. So, I guess you're saying, Eric, you've now got the audio gain set approximately right. KE2EJ, K2LIW?
Yeah, that's a little better. K2LIW, KE2EJ. Go back to what you're doing. Sorry to interrupt.
Okay, so you've got remote control. Remote control by which you can set the gain, and hopefully now it's better so that Joe will be happier. Alrighty. Yeah, direction finding is a real art and science. I believe there's a section specifically dedicated to this that's in the Skolnick book, Radar Handbook, and also Introduction to Radar. I believe it's got a direction finding section. I'm trying to remember, if you just do a Google search on direction finding techniques, radio frequency direction finding techniques, it falls into about 3 or 4 major categories. Doppelscan is one of them. Simultaneous amplitude comparison is a very popular one. That's where you've got a number of antennas dispersed in various azimuth directions as to where their best reception is, and you've got simultaneous receivers looking at those antennas and comparing the output amplitudes. That's called the simultaneous amplitude comparison technique. Another one is time of arrival. You could say that the doppelscan is a subset of the TOA technique. By having multiple antennas in various locations, the signal coming from a particular direction will arrive at each of the antennas in different times, depending on the exact range between the transmitter and those individual antennas. That's the TOA technique. So the phase shift technique, the doppelscan, time of arrival, amplitude comparison. There are other techniques where a subset of simultaneous amplitude comparison is where each individual antenna pattern has a Gaussian shape when plotted in rectangular form. In other words, if you're plotting azimuth horizontally and amplitude of response vertically, and if you set up the antenna so that they've got a rectified sine wave-like performance to each individual antenna, and if the antennas are dispersed in such a way that the 3 dB roll-off of one antenna is the 3 dB roll-up point on the other antenna, and when you get those shapes just right and the spacings just right, you can come up with an extremely simple technique that gives you a small number of degrees of inaccuracy in direction finding simply by comparing the amplitude of the two strongest signals. That's one of the techniques that I've worked on. Another one of the very
repeaters. Time out.
Another one of the very elaborate techniques is called the double dual differentiometer. Here we go. Double dual differentiometer, where you've got a reference antenna, a second antenna off to one side, which is called the narrow spacing, a third antenna off in the same direction, which is called the wide spacing, and if you're smart enough to choose the right ratio of the narrow and wide spacing, you trace out a phase shift between the antennas versus direction of arrival, where the phase shift becomes a sawtooth waveform on
phase versus azimuth on the wide spacing, a much finer phase shift versus azimuth on the wide spacing. You got a slow and a fast sawtooth waveform, and the two waveforms do not correlate, do not fold on top of each other anywhere. So you could say one is the coarse direction of arrival and the other is the fine, and you eliminate the ambiguity of the fine, which has got multiple cycles in there compared to the coarse. And that's an extremely effective technique, which I've worked on, which has 1 degree of accuracy, RMS accuracy, of approximately 1 degree in directional arrival when you set one of those systems up correctly. So that can be very handy. Some of the direction finding techniques that have been used in the past are Doppelscan and various receivers scattered around the particular town that you care about, where is the fox located. And there are techniques that have been used where the exact modulation technique of the particular transmitter is recognized because it has a particular signature to it. Anybody with any questions or comments on all of the above, give me a call, let us right now, K2LIW in the TechNet. Okay, I did want to say, I'm going to pass it over to Mel. I bet you guys have done some fox hunting in Brooklyn, and beyond using a field strength meter and driving around and looking for where the signal gets strongest, I wonder if any of you guys have used any of these other more elaborate techniques for fox hunting. Mel, K2KEY, K2RAW in the TechNet.
And you?
Alex is recognized after Mel. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Well, not recently. Years ago, we used to do quite a bit of that. Not with the current club, but when 2 meters came into fashion, really, that's when we started. I'm going back a long time, back to the AM days when people were running around basically with Johnson communicators. But it was really a different story in those days. Don't remember, you know, before repeaters, let's put it this way, before the repeaters came into vogue, there wasn't a heck of a lot of problems with jamming. So as of now, so far, you know, it's been pretty quiet here in Brooklyn. It seems like the jammers are sort of isolated to certain repeaters. And for some reason, I think Weimar seems to have more than its than its share. And yeah, I know about the situation in Texas. I talked to our mutual friend who told us what went on. I think that's maybe pushing the envelope a little bit for ham radio, but that's Texas, over.
Yeah, they tend to do everything in a big way out there. down out there. Quite a place. Yeah, I've only visited Texas twice in my life, and that's an interesting impression as to what it's like. In California a lot more often. Alex, you've got some further questions or comments? Go right ahead. NQNNU, K2LIW. Okay, I think we've gone down our list of everyone who signed in. Len, QEQ, disappeared. Paul's got a space report for us. And I think we've answered everyone's question that signed in with a question. Let me give one more call to make sure that we didn't forget somebody. Give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay, there being none. Paul, what's going on in space? I think there was a launch that was supposed to take place in the last week that got canceled because of some form of failure. Or the launch did take place and a failure occurred after the launch. Maybe you can tell us a little bit more about that. WS2N, if you're there. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, yeah, this is WS2N, and yeah, that's Discovery, STS 119. They've been trying to get that thing off the ground for the last month. Now that's delayed to March 12th. It was originally supposed to go off exactly a month ago. Delays due to a valve that had cracked on an Endeavour mission. It's come back in November. They evaluated these valves. They wanted to change them out. Apparently, I think there's some kind of blew off that valve from the hydrogen inside the shuttle. You know, it'll actually bleed back to the external fuel tank when it's sitting at launch. And then, you know, because of the track, they want to change these valves out. So that's been delayed. It's not taken off yet. That's going to go up to the International Space Station. It's not going to put the other missions during the rest of the year on hold right now. They're still within the time frame where future missions won't be delayed. I'm looking forward to a Hubble launch in May to repair the Hubble Space Telescope. Let me drop it. And if this delay goes on, it could affect the Hubble mission. If it goes on any later than presently planned, they have to delay the mission because there's a Soyuz mission that goes up to the International Space Station, and they can't have a Soyuz launch and a shuttle launch at the same time. They can't be at the space station at the same time. So hopefully that will work out okay. Looking forward to that. We talked about that mission. That's the where they're going to attach the final set of solar panels to the International Space Station. There's three sets up there now, and that'll bring the fourth one up. I just want to mention the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. That's that big spacecraft that's in orbit around Mars. Is presently not sending any science back. They believe it got blasted with a cosmic ray because it was a power surge. Now, this is an important spacecraft. This is the one that's taking pictures for future landing sites for manned and unmanned missions on Mars to extreme detail. It's actually taking photographs of the spacecraft sitting on the planet. Even taking pictures of the Phoenix spacecraft. There's one up there on a landed in the northern hemisphere of Mars. Actual picture of the spacecraft sitting there. In fact, they took pictures of it when it was going down. They have a picture of a parachute as it's parachuting through the atmosphere from the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. So they need this this thing. This is the big daddy of all the family of spacecraft presently orbiting Mars. Drop it. And apparently this power surge has knocked it out. They know it's okay. You know, they communicated with it. It was down to, what it does is, you can't have a fuse, of course. You can't go out and change it if there's a problem with power supply. So it resets everything, resets the computer, just shuts itself down and reboots everything. And then it looks for a signal from Earth to stop communicating, which actually worked. They were able to bring the 10-bit rate, it was a 40-bit rate up to, 10,000 times that amount. They were able to boost that. They could tell that the solar panels are bringing in power. They could tell that the batteries are charged. So they got some basic information. So they think that it shut itself down in the past, but there's different levels of this thing shutting itself down, and this one was shut down for. It also happened on the opposite side of the planet in relationship to us, so we could, they didn't have real time data on it. Not that it matters. I just get solar half-hour transmission from Mars to Earth anyway. So hopefully this thing will get back on track. Just wanted to also mention that China had a probe going around the moon. Let me drop it. This thing was launched a couple of years ago, and it's been orbiting the moon, getting information. They purposely crashed it into the moon. That mission is over. You know, these other countries, they're getting up there little by little. I mean, they've got China actually has a manned mission now, a manned space program. Put two people up last time. One of them did a space walk. You know, they're moving along. So hopefully we keep at it. You know, with all these billions of dollars being thrown around, you hear about it in the news every day. You know, NASA still has its $18 billion budget. It used to sound like a lot of money. Now, that's what they still have. And the President administration has actually increased the amount of money by a little bit in the last administration, but not by much. It's still in the $18 billion category. So, it's enough to keep their programs going. I haven't heard anything canceled yet. The space station is going to be completed. The Constellation program will come online for the new manned space program. No changes there. The Russians will send astronauts and cosmonauts to the space station for 5 years because the shuttle system will be still shut down in 2010. That hasn't changed. I thought maybe that might change, but I haven't heard that change. That date is still firm there. And that's pretty much it for now. Back to you, Dick. This is WS1.
Paul, how many more modules are going to be added to the International Space Station? How close to completion is it? And what's the anticipated date at which it'll be completed? And I just like you, I'm also disappointed that we're discontinuing the shuttle in 2010, and I guess the new system will not be available until 2015, and therefore will be thoroughly dependent on the Soyuz system for those 5 years. That's not a comfortable situation. But getting back to International Space Station, how many more modules, how many more years, how close is it to completion? Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, okay, well, module-wise, we have the third part of the Kaibo. Kaibo is the Japanese contribution. There was actually three launches that involved that. It's actually two modules, and then this third one is an outside platform that will be attached to it. That was actually the biggest of the group. They want to bring up what they call a cupola, which is it's similar to an air traffic control tower. I guess you put that on one of the nodes, you'd be able to have a couple guys float up in there and have these windows. As you look out, the trapezoidal windows surrounding, as you look out, so you can look at out at 180 degrees and see what's going on with the spacecraft, look at the station itself. I heard that's still a go, and we canceled that. They were thinking about that, canceling it. This truss section is the final truss section. After this, I think that's pretty much it. It's just supplies and changing of crews. You've got all your main modules up there. Discovery, Destiny by the United States has dropped. Three Kaibo units by Japan. You've got the Columbus module mounted up there by European Space Agency. The Habitat one, that was canceled. That was going to be actually a private field sent up that was going to store another module for tourists. That was planned at the beginning of the space station. That was canceled. Then you've got your Russian modules. You've got two of them. All the interconnecting nodes. So that's your living quarters. And it's enough equivalent space of the inside of a, bigger than the inside of a 747. If you go, close from one end to the other, there's a lot of interior room. Each module is connected by a hatchway that they flow through. So, all these hatches dump one end to the other. I don't know if it appears that big when you're in there, but if you were to flow from one end to the other, it's more than a 747 deck back here.
Sure is a nice piece of volume. And one last question. Has anyone projected when the end date of the International Space Station is? Do we stop using it in the year 2020 or something like that? Go ahead.
No, it's going to go beyond that. The original life lifespan of this thing was supposed to be 15 years. First pieces went up, what, 1999? So, you know, I mean, from completion, you know, even everything's been delayed. You know, in between that time, you had the Columbia disaster, 2003. That delayed things for a couple of years. So this thing should have been built and finished probably 2 years ago. And then from that date on, another 15 years. They're going to keep that longer than that. Because they always, I mean, they did that with their Mir space station, too. That was supposed to be down, you know, 10 years before it actually was deorbited. So I'm going to guess this thing will be up there, you know, for the next 20 years. They'll probably use it for another 20 years. That's my guess. You know, they keep extending things. Even this reconnaissance mission that I told you about earlier, I mean, that was only supposed to be 2 years, and they're already into their next 2 year extension on it. So it's just that, you know, it goes on and on. Until they see problems, I think they'll keep orbiting the space station. Maybe even add to it. Back to you.
Spirit and Opportunity are funded for how much longer, Paul? And is the current anticipation that the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter may fully recover? No permanent damage? Back to you, Paul.
Out of the two articles I read on the internet, the engineers and people who call managers in charge believe that they're going to gain full recovery of the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. So, you know, from what I read, that looks good. I don't have any technical reasons why they think that, outside of that they are communicating with it, and it's only a matter of bringing it back to life. Spirit and Opportunity, their original plan was for 3 months, and now it's been over 5 years. 2004, January, they both landed. Here we are in 2009. So they're over 5 years riding around on the surface. Each time it comes up for a review, they just extend the time for the spacecraft. They just allocate more money. It's a lot cheaper to pay, you know, operators and engineers, scientists that are involved down here than sending more flights up there. Here they are, they're already there. You know, it's the biggest bang for the dollar that they could have ever imagined. And that holds true with all the Cassini spacecraft around Saturn and Galileo, which is the orbiter that was going around Jupiter. I mean, every one of them, you know, every one I can think of has had extended missions. Yeah, they just reallocate money for funding here on Earth to keep it going. So as long as they run, they'll run them to the ground. Phoenix, of course, they knew that wasn't going to last, but even that doubled its life. They knew that the cost of carbon dioxide was going to set in, and light was going to disappear because of the tilt of the planet. But even Phoenix had an extended mission involved. They doubled that, but of course that one's dead now. Back to you, Rick.
Fine. Thank you, Paul. Anybody have any further questions for Paul before we go over to Mel and we use his mailbag? Give me your call letters right now.
W2OYY. Another question for Paul, but I have a question for you again.
Go right ahead, Joe.
Back to the antenna problem with the multiple elements here. What would you say the reflector-driven element and the first director should be properly as far as the second?
Okay. Director, reflector, and driven element, you were asking a question. I'm guessing spacing. And each Yagi design requests a different spacing of those elements, if that was your question. There was a blast of noise that came in at the end there, Joe. If I misunderstood your question, go ahead and repeat it.
It's funny how that noise comes and goes.
I'm hearing you directly on, I'm listening to you right now on 975-375. So repeat the question again, Joe.
I'm looking for the percentage change between the reflector driven element and first director, so I can get an approximate idea of where this antenna is working at its current frequencies before I play with it, the element length. The length is what I'm talking about. That's what I'm saying. That's very important.